Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. This week, we're celebrating the second anniversary of this podcast. If the pod has made a difference for you, please show us some love by letting us know how over on our second anniversary page at twimmelai.com/2AV. We want to hear the ways the podcast has helped you or your business, how it's enabled you to find or connect to resources you found valuable, or how it's educated you about new and interesting topics. Submit your written or audio comments via the page we've set up, and we'll be sharing a few of your stories, with your permission, of course, in a special podcast episode celebrating the Twimmel community. In today's show, I sit down with David Van Valen, Assistant Professor of Bioengineering and Biology at Caltech. David joined me after his talk at the Figure 8 Train AI conference to chat about his research using image recognition and segmentation techniques in biological settings. In particular, we discuss his use of deep learning to automate the analysis of individual cells in live cell imaging experiments. We had a really interesting discussion around the various practicalities he's learned about training deep neural networks for image analysis, and he shares some awesome insights into which of the techniques from the deep learning research have worked for him and which haven't. If you're a fan of our Nerd Alert shows, you'll really like this one. Before we jump in, I'd like to send a shout out to our friends over at Figure 8 for their continued support of the show and their sponsorship of this week's series, which all took place at Train AI. Figure 8 is the essential human-in-the-loop AI platform for data science and machine learning teams. The Figure 8 software platform trains, tests, and tunes machine learning models to make AI work in the real world. Learn more at www.figure-8.com. Just a reminder, this episode was recorded live on site, so there's some unavoidable background noise. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am here with David Van Valen at the Train AI conference. David is assistant professor in the biology and bioengineering department at Caltech. David, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Why don't we get started by having you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came into AI as a biologist?
So I can start. I can start from the beginning. So I was born in Los Angeles. Grew up on the East Coast, upstate New York for middle school and West Virginia for high school.
Where upstate?
So we lived in Liverpool, which is within an hour of Syracuse.
Okay.
So it was very, it was upstate enough where things like lake effect snow were a very, it was a reality.
Okay. I asked because I grew up in New York City and went to school upstate at RPI.
Okay.
Oh, and awesome. At Troy, New York.
Yeah. I'm familiar with RPI. They have very, very good students. Yeah. And so went to high school in West Virginia and, graduated, went to college. So I went to MIT and I was a double major in math and physics. At the same time, I had the luxury of being, having like freshman biology taught by like Eric Lander, who's, you know, big shot scientist who like runs like the Broad Institute between like MIT and Harvard. You know, he was like one of the big early pioneers in like the Human Genome Research Project. And he was also has a background as a mathematician. And so the way he explained biology really resonated with me and made me want to like sort of continue that thread further. And so after I finished at MIT, I went to the MD-PhD program at UCLA and Caltech. And so the way that program works is you spend first two years doing medical school, then you do your PhD, and then you return for your clinical training. And I did my PhD at Caltech in the Applied Physics Department with Rob Phillips. And there, it was a really great environment because there's exposure to sort of, you know, thinking about problems in biology using like ideas from physics. Mm-hmm. But then there were some very quantitative experiments that we're doing as well. And so there was a lot of imaging, there was a lot of image analysis, and there was a lot of image segmentation. And so image segmentation, you know, figuring out what parts of your images correspond to like which objects you care about. We had to do a lot of that. And so that was sort of like my first exposure to those sorts of problems. And there's sort of this given where if you were sort of the more mathy type and you could do the physics calculations, then people just assumed that you're going to be good at doing the image segmentation and that you'd figure out how to get those tools to work to solve like your problems of interest. And, you know, by and large, like, you know, they're right, but it's still like a separate skill set that you have to learn. And yeah, and so that was probably like my first introduction to computer vision, to image segmentation, image recognition, was during my graduate training. Finished my PhD in 2011, finished my MD 2013, so I went back to clinical training from 2011 to 2013, and, you know, got like more exposure to problems in, clinical medicine. And then after that, I went up to Stanford to continue training as a postdoctoral fellow. And so I was up at Stanford for about 4 or 5 years with Marcus Covert in the bioengineering department. And there's when I started getting into sort of like the more machine learning / AI space. And
so your initial exposure to computer vision was more traditional tools as
traditional
opposed to
tools,
machine learning.
So
based.
If you're doing edge finding, filtering, thresholding, watershed transforms,
okay,
you know, wavelets, all of that, you know, that was my first exposure. And so what you would usually end up doing is you'd have an idea of like what these tools did and how each one worked, and then you'd basically bash some collection of these tools together to work on like your problem like of interest.
Okay.
And so the experiments that we were doing at the time, I think you probably saw some of it at the talk that I gave yesterday, is, you know, we'd have these images of cells. And so at the let me just give a backstory of the talk for your listeners. So part of the talk I was sort of showing like what I was doing during my graduate work. We were very interested in like the life cycle of these viruses, and in particular how these viruses got their DNA from inside the viral capsid into like the bacterial cell. Didn't really have an idea of how it worked, and so we had this idea to create an experiment to like let us watch. And so the challenge was, can you figure out a way to look at one piece of DNA being transferred from like inside the virus to inside the cell? The answer is yes, you can. You have to use these very particular kind of dye that will stain the DNA while it's inside the viral capsid, and then you can watch the dye molecules get transferred between the virus into the bacterial cell. And so you get these gorgeous movies, but what we then have to do is quantify these movies so you can, you know, have some sense of the dynamics of this process.
And to get a sense of the type of movie that we're looking at, like,
yeah,
what's the field of view in terms of how zoomed in this is? Are you looking at one transfer, one organism, or is it many, many that you have to figure out?
For one paper's worth of data, there's roughly about 50... or so events that you're looking at.
Okay.
And it's not that often. So you're generally looking at maybe like a few hundreds field of view. There might be, you know, somewhere between 20 to 100 or so cells within that field of view. And, you know, of those cells, maybe like a couple will have like an infection event.
Within what time period?
Within the time period of about 30 minutes. So these movies were taken in roughly like one snapshot every 30 seconds to every minute. And, you know, that's sort of like how the that data was collected.
Okay.
Granted, it's been about 7 years since I collected that data set. But from what I remember, that's what we did. And so you get these gorgeous movies. And so what you need to then do is, you know, identify, okay, which part of the movie or which pixels within each frame correspond to like the cells, which ones correspond to background, which ones correspond to the virus, which ones correspond to the viruses that we actually care about. And then once you've done that, then you can go and quantify your images, right? And so you can ask, you know, how bright were the viruses over time? How bright were the cells over time? And use that to generate, you know, some like quantitative curves of here's how much DNA was being transferred as a function of time. And then once you have like that those curves, then you can go and do your, you know, your fancy modeling, your physics, and, you know, determine, okay, well, from this set of hypotheses for how I think this process is happening, you know, which ones are actually like consistent with like the data that we've generated.
Mm. So when you're trying to determine the brightness, which tells you how much DNA was transferred, is this how much in terms of the length of the sequence that's transferred or some other
quantity? That's ideally like what you want is like how many base pairs or how many nanometers worth of DNA has been transferred like over time. And so you kind of use a calibration curve. So you know at the beginning of the event, you know, the virus has about 48 kilobase pairs of DNA. At the end of the event, like it should have zero, and use some like linear interpolation, you know, assuming that, you know, linearly related, you know, brightness versus like how much DNA. And then you can like infer from the movies, go from brightness to length of amount of DNA.
So where does machine learning and AI fit into all that?
So machine learning and AI fits in how do you do like the object, how do you do like the object recognition, the image segmentation? And, you know, that experiment was, you know, it was sort of like the classical computer vision approaches that we used to analyze that data. And when I started my postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford, I had ideas for experiments that I'd like to do. And basically what I wanted to do was, you know, look at genome scale knockout libraries image them and then look at them with single cell resolution.
So what's a genome scale knockout library?
Genome scale knockout library is a collection of strains where in each strain you have one gene that's been removed or inactivated. And so if you're interested in, you know, say like a particular like biological process, so the ones that the one that I was interested in at the time and that my lab is currently interested in are host virus interactions. And so you want to understand how do viruses and their hosts talk to each other and what parts of the host are important for that communication. There are experiments that you can do where if you have a way to look at the communication using imaging, then you can basically go one by one, remove a gene from like the host. And if that gene was important, then that's going to alter what the communication was or what like the outcome of the viral infection ended up being. And, you know, that's what
the host in this case is the
host in this case the virus, is not the virus, but the cell that's infecting.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. And you're removing that particular sequence prior to the infection?
To the infection.
Okay.
And so you've got a control experiment, you've got a control where nothing's been removed. And then you have a collection of strains where in each strain, one gene has been removed. And so there are collections that like this that exist for certain strains of E. coli. There are collections that exist for yeast. People at the Chan's Upper Initiative are creating collections like this that exist for, you know, mammalian cells. And these are really powerful tools because, you know, because they exist in like this arrayed format where one well of a dish will have one strain that has one gene removed. Mm-hmm. Then you can systematically go one by one and ask, okay, does this removal, does that influence what I was interested in studying? So mm-hmm. in this case, does it influence the outcome of a particular viral infection? So what we want to do is to be able to read out a screen of this library using imaging mm-hmm. and imaging with single cell resolution. There you're going from the case of where you're doing, you know, 50 or 100 or 1,000 cells to doing millions, and there you don't have the luxury of being able to like go back and like manually correct like segmentation errors. You really need something that's going to work 99% of the time, if not better. And that's where the machine learning comes in. And so I remember when I was a medical student, I was sort of like browsing Facebook, and I realized like, hey, you know, Facebook actually knows like where the faces are in, you know, in like all the images I'm uploading. Not only that, but it has like ideas of like who's in these pictures. Like, is it you? Is it like your, you know, like your one of your three like best friends? And, you know, just, you know, I've done like a lot of microscopy in my over my career, and it's like I know that the images that I collect on the microscope are a lot simpler than the images of like me doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu or hanging out with my friends at like a party or whatnot.
Right.
You know, what are those guys doing, and can I steal it or borrow or co-opt, but, you know, Rally is like, you know, blatant theft. You know, can I take those tools and then repurpose them to like work on our microscopy data? And so the answer was, you know, the answer is yes. The time that I started my postdoc and started to like think about these issues again was literally right as the deep learning inflection curve started to take off.
Okay.
And so it turned out, you know, yes, you can repurpose these tools, and it, you know, it ends up working like really, really, really well. And so we had a paper that we did in PLOS Computational Biology, basically showing that for the single cell image segmentation problem, the existing tools work as well as the state of the art for across a variety of different cell types. So whether you're imaging bacteria, whether you're imaging mammalian cells in cell culture, if you're looking at phase images, if you're looking at fluorescence microscopy images, that, you know, the tools work really well. And it's at a point that, you know, people in the cell biology community, you know, really need to start taking like a really close look at these tools and, you know, start thinking about like, how can these change the way that I do my experiments, and what experiments will they let me do that would previously have been like impossible?
Okay.
Yeah.
And so did you use off the shelf CNNs and that kind of stuff? Or
so
did
like
you have
I
to...
started, yeah. So like I started at the beginning. And so, yeah. So at the time, Karis, when I first started, Andre Karpathy put together and Fei-Fei Li put together like their first CS231 end course, which I think is now kind of like iconic in the field. I got to sit on that for a couple weeks to like sort of like get familiarize myself with the field enough to the point where I can go and like, you know, hack some piece of code together. Keras didn't really exist at the time. Cafe was like a new thing. TensorFlow didn't exist. And it was basically, you know, do you want to learn CUDA or were you like, okay, like learning like Theano? And so when I first started, I was programming in like naked Theano, had to figure out how to pipe data into like, you know, simple like CNN architectures. How do you like save models? How do you like, you know, once you like save parameters, like how do you load it? Like the really nice frameworks that exist today, like those didn't exist at the time. And so, you know, sort of like had to like figure like all those things out, get some like hacky pieces of code that would work. But the first, like basically like the very simplest, you know, CNN architectures that you could write down ended up working really well. And actually, like, as far as the stuff that my lab uses in production for the data that we analyze and the data that we analyze with our collaborators, we, you know, still use those like very simple neural network architectures. I would say like there's a lot of like really cool stuff that people have done, but I found it very useful to pay attention to what's going to generalize on small data sets as opposed to, you know, what's the latest and greatest that are out there. And, you know, just from like my own personal experience, you know, some of the things that will perform like really well on ImageNet, like say like residual networks, they have issues with overfitting. And if you don't have like that large corpus of data where your network can learn all of the edge cases, you'll get more like practical utility from like, you know, the simpler neural networks trained in a way where you like you're doing like the regularization and the, you know, normalization and like the post-processing like correctly.
And so was your training data the data sets that you had traditionally created using manual segmentation or traditional computer vision?
Yeah, so those were... So I would say like this is true in academia and it's true in life, is that if you want to get people excited about something, like first you have to prove that it's going to work. And so the first generation of training data, like I created like myself. And so I annotated a couple images of bacterial cells in ImageJ, and, you know,
ImageJ is
a Java program that people
at the end, labeling box, bounding box tool or something
like
that?
It's a general purpose image visualization and also image analysis toolkit that the NIH supports.
Okay.
And so they have tools for annotating images. It's relatively clunky, but it worked then and it works now. For some cases, like we still use it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I generated it. It worked.
You threw out a few different numbers. Mm-hmm. When you said a couple of images.
Yeah.
Is this a couple of images with 50 things that need to be annotated, or a couple of images with a million things that need to be annotated?
A couple of images with a couple with about 100-ish things that need to be annotated.
Okay.
And we paid for the PLOS computational biology paper, and even now we paid very close attention to data augmentation. We paid a lot of attention to normalizing images before they go into like the neural network, so you can account for like variations in image acquisition. And we paid a lot of attention. We paid like a good amount of attention to post-processing, what happens to like the output of the neural networks afterwards, and can you still leverage some of the classical tools that you use in computer vision, like the watershed transform, like active contours or whatnot, to sort of refine like what the neural network produces to produce something that you can like actually like use on like real data. And we found that by like paying attention to, like those things, you know, you don't have to use like the latest and greatest, you know, stuff in the neural networks in the deep learning space. Relatively simple things with those things like paid attention to work like really well.
Mm-hmm. And did you iterate to paying attention to all those things, or did you just kind of start there and that's what worked and you kept doing it?
While I was iterating, people create like really, really great pieces of work all the time. And like, there's just an innately curious part of me wondering like, how well will that stuff work on the data sets that we've generated and that other people have generated, sort of like in this space. And now that I'm running my own group, I have people to sort of like help explore like that space. I will say that we're primarily interested in like the scientific questions that we can answer with these tools. And that curiosity kind of like drives our interest in the deep learning space. I find it like interesting and mathematically elegant. We're not necessarily like deep learning for like deep learning's sake. It's more like deep learning, you know, because like we have like real problems that we're trying to address.
That's the way it should be.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
So you mentioned a few kind of tricks and techniques that you paid attention to, data augmentation.
Yeah.
How did you go about that, or what were some of the highlights, or anything stand out in terms of, you know, doing this really made it work for us? Or was it standard kind of, you know, rotating things around and changing brightness levels and that kind of thing?
I would say like the things that we found that worked is just like being like trying to be as systematic as we could with the things that we tried. And so like we have so I can like just go through the list of things that we tried for our PLOS computational biology paper. The usual like data augmentation things that we've tried. So image rotations, image flipping, those things like really matter. I would say there were some things that we tried that didn't really make so much of an impact. So image shearing. And so shearing is another operation that you can do to augment your data. We found that didn't really like impact like performance of like the neural networks that we got. I would say paying attention to how you're doing the training made an impact. And so we found that for us, the simpler stochastic gradient descent with Nesterov momentum that ended up being better, roughly speaking, than, you know, RMS prop, Atom, et cetera, et cetera. But that was also conditioned on like what networks that we were using and like what features we had within those networks. And so batch normalization sort of influences like which one is going to work better, whether you're using like dropout or using like batch normalization. Like with dropout, we tend not to do that.
If we're using batch normalization, then
we generally speaking don't use dropout. And I would say that we generally speaking don't use dropout that much. I don't know how general this quote unquote finding is, but one thing that we noticed was if you look at let me just take like a brief second to sort of like say like how we do like our neural network training. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of repose. Yeah. So what we're trying, basically like the task that we're trying to do is instant segmentation. And so for your listeners who are sort of like familiar with this space, it's the same task that networks like MaskR CNN solve. We started working on this before MaskR CNN came out. And, you know, so there's sort of like, you know, different ways of like slicing that apple. The way that we did it is a framework that Dan Cirasan posed in a paper many years ago, which is recasting the instant segmentation problem as an image classification problem and trying to classify like every pixel as either being an interior, being inside an object, in this case, inside a single cell, being at the boundary of a single cell, or being as part of the background. And you can looking at things in that way, then, you know, it's basically like an image classification problem. We train using like sample wise training. And so we basically have these, we have like these maps of what every pixel like should be. We crop like a small area around like each pixel, feed that into a deep convolutional neural network to do the classification. And once it's trained, we basically use dilated convolutions and dilated pooling kernels to run that classification neural network on an entire image to generate like dense predictions.
What are dilated convolutions and dilated?
So dilated convolutions are basically if you take your convolutional kernel, dilations are basically just like inserting zeros in between the weights of your convolutional kernel. And there's a similar thing in the pooling kernel.
Pooling.
Yeah. And so it turns out you kind of have to do that because you're training this neural network to do pixel-wise classification. Once it's trained to do dense prediction, if you try to feed it in patch by patch, if you have two neighboring pixels, then basically all of the patches around it are essentially redundant computations. And so you need to use like the dilated kernels to, you know, get like a fully convolutional execution.
And so does your dilation factor end up being like a hyperparameter?
No, it's like mathematically like exact. If you dilate things in the right way, then it ends up being like mathematically the same as like running everything like doing like patchwise prediction.
Okay.
So I got like sidetracked on on that. So like there's a reason. I mean, this happens to me like all the time as I'm getting older.
We were talking about the kind of various ways you've tweaked the process, and you mentioned that you know, while there are some newer approaches to segmentation, you kind of rolled your own based on a paper and ended up using this dilation as a way to do the pixel by pixel.
Okay. Yeah. So, and we're also talking about like what parts did we find or what augmentation.
What was useful and what wasn't. Right?
Yeah. So like the output of this, this approach is you get like probability maps for what's like inside of a cell, what's a cell boundary and what's like a background. If you use drop, and so for the post-processing, it's actually helpful to have like some notion of uncertainty. And so if the neural network is like not sure, it's easier for the post-processing for, let's say there's a pixel where it's not sure, it's more useful to have that pixel value be like 0.5 instead of, you know, making a very certain like false call. And so what we found with some of our experiments with dropout is that it was essentially removing some of the uncertainty that was encoded in these probability maps. And that made it a little harder to do like the downstream processing. That's why I kind of like shy away from dropout. I don't know like how general this is. But this is like, that was like one of the empirical observations that, you know, I've noted during like my my time experimenting with these things. Other things that like really help, more training data. The more data that you have to capture more and more edge cases, then like the better the neural networks are going to perform. We found that roughly if you have like standardized like acquisition conditions and you collect your training data on like the same acquisition conditions, then you really only need, I'd say like on the order of like a few hundred to 1,000 cells to get like neural networks and to be like good enough to analyze like subsequent experiments. But the more training data that you get, then the better that it's going to be. And I think now we're getting to the point where we're having like more and more like data sets that are like publicly available. So when we published our paper in PLOS Computational Biology, we released like all the data sets we annotated. I think it was on the order of like maybe like, you know, 10 to 15-ish images. It was quite a bit of work to do. But, you know, I'm a big fan of if you're publishing something, you know, make everything that you're doing like openly available. And I think like, as we're seeing, there's more, people are recognizing that the challenges in this space aren't necessarily like the algorithms anymore. It's like having access to like good, like high quality data, right? If you give someone, you know, a good data set, you know, there's going to be like some nerd in some basement, you know, who's like lives on Stack Overflow is going to be able to put together like some kind of machine learning solution using that data set. It's just, are there data sets that are out there? And I think now we're starting to see like more and more data sets like in this space. And so the ones that come to mind, so I think There was one that was released by the Broad Institute. It was like part of like the 2018 Kaggle Data Science competition for doing nuclear segmentation. That was one of the things that we tackled in our PLOS computational biology paper. But more data sets on more data types, and you'll get better neural networks. And as we saw today, Figure 8 is releasing annotated data on H&E pathology images for doing nuclear segmentation on a variety of like different tissue types. And so I think like the more and more data sets that we have that cover more and more use cases, then like the closer we're going to get to actually having like general tools that, you know, people be able to use like off the shelf, which I think is going to be like really, really awesome. So yeah, in my view, like I view this space as the challenges. I don't want to like downplay how hard it is to like get started like in machine learning and deep learning. It's like, you know, of course there's like challenges and issues, but it's really, I'd say like data sets are like one big challenge, and deployment is another challenge. Once you have like a neural network that's trained to like do your task, how you give it to like other people so they can use it for their problems and like their data.
Yeah. And have you started to tackle that one at all? Or
one thing that I talked about at my talk yesterday was, you know, sort of like what are we working on in the deep learning space? One is just deployment in experiments that we do in our lab that requires, you know, a little bit more training data, because like the experiments that we like to do are sort of like large scale imaging. And then also deploying these neural networks so you can do like segmentation in tissues, right? So there's sort of like the, you know, well-controlled, you know, cell culture type experiments, but then there's the messier world of, you know, imaging in, you know, real life tissues that, you know, pathologists do. And so these require different scales of training data. And the things that you'd really like to do in these spaces are either like very complicated tissues, or having three-dimensional data sets. So being able to do two dimensions in space plus time, or being able to do like three dimensions in space, say like you're using like a confocal microscopy setup or another like more sophisticated instrument. And so that requires a different scale of training data, because instead of annotating a couple frames to be able to look at the objects, you have to be able to like annotate like entire movies. And that's what I've been working with people at Figure 8 with, is how do you train people on the crowd to like do these sorts of tasks? I think at the end of the talk, I think we showed, you know, sort of like some of like the stuff that's hot off the press. I think we're just now getting people in the crowd able to annotate the 3D data sets. Robert Monroe showed being able to, you know, do like object tracking in the crowd. I'm super, super excited about that, because I think that's one of the, you know, one of the big challenges in live cell imaging. And, you know, to do that, what you need are, you know, nice annotated data sets. And so we've been working on annotating on issues with like crowdsourcing, like data set annotation. We're also thinking about deployment as well. And so there are a lot of things to think about there. I would say there's a difference between what I like to call like academic software, which is, you know, someone has like a cool idea. They put together a nice set of scripts in Python or MATLAB or R. And for MATLAB and R, they're relatively like well-contained environments, and you can give someone a .m file or an R file, and it'll kind of work on another MATLAB installation. But Python's a different beast. Everybody's got like their own version, their own implementation, and for all the different stacks.
Tons of different libraries.
And so that's a problem, yeah. Right? Is that I can't give somebody like a link to my GitHub and say like, good luck. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more work that has to be done. And so, you know, it's basically, you know, doing your due diligence, looking at like the best tools that are out there for solving these problems. Mm-hmm. We have switched to doing like our development inside of NVIDIA Docker now, and we're looking as to use that for, you know, deployment. So like we have collaborators who use some of the scripts that we generate. Mm-hmm. And now instead of, you know, giving them like, hey, here's like the Python file, you know, hey, here's like a Docker container, mm-hmm. That has like all of the packages installed.
Okay.
And, you know, there's layers of work that has to be done like on top of that. ideally, you know, you'd have like your Docker container up and running. You'd have stuff like wrapped within like a web framework. You have, you know, that back end talking to like a front end with some semblance of like a user interface. And now that I have like a team of people thinking of these sorts of issues, you know, we're thinking of like just implementing some of these things to like have it easier for people like within the lab, people within the labs that we collaborate with, and also like the people who, you know, download our stuff and use it, make it easier for them to use too.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, David, this has been really, really interesting. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. I would like to thank like a few people, if I'm like allowed.
go right ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to thank the graduate students, who have, been rotating with me like the last, this quarter. So Dylan Bannon and Nadia Vilovich. I've got to thank, people I've worked with at Stanford. And so I had the privilege of working with Nicholas Quach, who's a very talented undergrad who did a lot of the experiments I talked about yesterday. My postdoctoral advisor, Marcus Covert, he was great. And it was his lab that, sort of gave me like the intellectual freedom to start exploring like these, sets of issues, you know, looking at like AI and the interface with, the biological sciences. I had a great, great ongoing collaboration with, Michelangelo, who's a professor in the pathology department at Stanford. He's done amazing, amazing stuff on digital pathology and developing like the next platform of digital pathology instruments that will let you look at literally, you know, dozens of different biological markers within tissues. And he's had an amazing postdoctoral fellow, Liat Karen, who I worked with as well. Unfortunately, you didn't get to stick around for the talk yesterday, but I talked about some of the work I was doing with them. Okay. And also like to thank Casey Wong and Long Kai. I do work with their labs as well.
Awesome.
So yeah.
Awesome. And of course the folks at Figure Eight for supporting your work and having us here at the podcast.
Folks at Figure Eight, Andy, Justin, Robert, everybody's been amazing. Their openness it's a model that people in academia should pay attention to as far as like collaborations between like academia and industry, like the things that Figure Eight's allowing my lab to do and the resources they've given us, like the work that, you know, we're doing and we're going to do would not be possible like without them.
Fantastic.
Should also thank other funders, NIH, Burroughs Wellcome Fund, Paul Allen Family Foundation. They funded a large amount of work, and also the Division of Biology and Bioengineering at Caltech for hosting my laboratory and also funding us as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on David or any of the topics covered in this episode, head on over to twimlai.com/talk/141. Thanks again to Figure Eight for their sponsorship of this episode. To follow along with the Train AI series, visit twimlai.com/trainai2018. And last, but not least, go ahead and show us some love for our second anniversary and share how the podcast has been helpful to you over at twimlai.com/2AV, the number 2AV. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.